Sixth Interlude, The Stages of an Adept. Stages 7 through 10 describe the maturing practice of an adept meditator. This section of the path differs from previous stages in four important ways. First, you don't need to acquire any new skills. Just keep practicing the skills you've already mastered, and they'll produce profound changes in how the mind system works. Second, everything occurring in these stages is actually part of a single, continuous process, unification of mind. Third, as unification proceeds, you'll experience a variety of bizarre sensory phenomena, spontaneous body movements, and the arising of powerful energy. These accompany transformations occurring in the mind system and eventually culminate in the unique practice of physical pliancy and meditative joy. Fourth, the practice of an adept inevitably leads to powerful insight experiences, rich with the potential for actual insight. The transition from skilled to adept practice, from training the mind to transforming the mind. The transition from skilled to adept meditator essentially means shifting from training the mind to transforming the mind. Understanding this difference is very important. There are so many new methods introduced in the coming stages that it's possible to become preoccupied with technique. Successfully achieving shamatha while unwittingly dismissing insight opportunities as mere disruptions of your practice. Don't let this happen. The real point of adept practice is reshaping your mind into a powerful instrument capable of the kind of investigation that produces insight and awakening. Up to this point, all your progress has been the result of skill development. In stages 4 through 6, you trained yourself so noticing and correcting for distraction or dullness became automatic. Now, as a meditator who's mastered the skills for stabilizing attention and generating powerful mindfulness, you can consistently achieve exclusive focus. However, the transition from skill development to transforming the way the mind works actually began in stage 6 with pacifying the mind. Continuously applying the skill of ignoring mental objects caused a shift in functioning of the mind system that kept the problem from arising in the first place. The discriminating mind stopped projecting mental objects into consciousness as potential distractions. Metacognitive awareness and the acquired appearance of the meditation object are other examples of shifts in mental functioning that resulted from simply continuing to exercise certain skills. The pacification in stage 6 was only partial and temporary, because when you relaxed your effort, thoughts and other mental objects once again rose into consciousness to compete for attention. As pacification continues in stage 7, however, an even more fundamental change in the mind system occurs, one that completely eliminates the cause of the problem. A significant proportion of the discriminating sub-minds, rather than simply growing quiet, become unified in support of the single, conscious intention to sustain an exclusive focus of attention. The result is complete pacification of the discriminating mind, also known as mental pliancy. With mental pliancy, exclusive focus and powerful mindfulness can be effortlessly sustained for long periods. These are the changes that make you an adept practitioner. In fact, everything from stage 7 onward happens not because our skills improve any further, but because the mind system itself starts functioning differently. Specifically, by consistently applying the skills we've already mastered, the mind becomes more and more unified. This is the fundamental difference between the practice of an adept and everything that has preceded it. Skill development versus mastery. To give you a sense of the difference between developing basic skills versus the exercise of mastery, think of what it means to become a virtuoso musician. First, You must master all the necessary skills, scales, chord progressions, ornamentations, and so on. Once those skills are mastered, you then move into the realm of artistry, which involves improvisation, mood, and nuance. Skills provide you with the foundation, but creative improvisation moves at another level and needs its own process of maturation. Yet another aspect of virtuosity is cooperative interaction. When playing in a group, any flourish added by one musician must fit in with the performance of the group as a whole. The same is true with unification of a multi-part mind system. Every sub-mind must function in a way that's harmonious with the rest of the system. An overview of the unification process. Stages 7 through 10 involve a profound unification of the mind. This doesn't mean the mind somehow fuses into a single, monolithic entity. Rather, the many discriminating and sensory sub-minds start working together in harmony. This unification is what gives rise to shamatha. This overview describes the sequence of events in the unification process and what happens at each stage. As you will see, some events unfold across several stages. For example, pacification of the discriminating mind begins at stage 6 and continues through stage 7. The relationship of individual stages to the overall process will become clear as we go along. Pacifying the mind began at stage 6 and continues into stage 7. The activities of the discriminating sub-minds have largely receded from consciousness, rarely appearing as anything more than indistinct whispers. Still, it takes continuous effort to keep these potentially distracting objects at bay. Complete pacification of the discriminating mind in stage 7 means the discriminating sub-minds have become highly unified. By the end of this stage, you can effortlessly sustain stable attention and powerful mindfulness. This quality of effortlessness is called mental pliancy, which is the defining characteristic of the mind in stage 8. As unification of the mind as a whole proceeds, pacification of the senses begins. This process is similar to pacifying the discriminating mind, except it involves unifying the sensory sub-minds. It occurs mostly in stage 8, but can be a significant part of stage 7 as well. With the senses fully pacified, all but the most intrusive external sounds fade away, and auditory awareness is often dominated by an inner sound. All visual imagery ceases, and the visual sense is often dominated by an inner light, and the usual bodily aches and pains, itching, numbness, and other sensations are replaced by a pleasant feeling of stability and stillness. With this further unification and the complete pacification of the senses, physical pliancy arises. Physical pliancy allows a meditator to sit for hours without physical discomfort or sensory distractions. When you get up after a long sit, you will feel strong and vigorous, without stiffness or limbs that have fallen asleep. Physical pliancy is accompanied by the bliss of physical pliancy. This is a wonderful feeling of bodily pleasure and comfort that seems either to suffuse the entire body from inside or else to cover it like a blanket or second skin of pleasurable sensation. Pacification of the senses, physical pliancy, and the bliss of physical pliancy can appear intermittently in stage 7, but only develop fully in stage 8. Meditative joy is a joyful state of mind arising due to further unification of the mind in stage 8. It's usually accompanied by an experience of powerful energy currents circulating through the body. Meditative joy fully matures shortly after physical pliancy, giving rise to the bliss of mental pliancy. This is a feeling of happiness. Meditative joy, as a mental state, is quite different from the bliss of mental pliancy, which is the pleasurable mental feeling that accompanies it. The state of meditative joy and the bliss of mental pliancy can be so intense and exciting that they become enormously distracting, so much so that a practitioner may stop meditating to go talk to someone about them. Meditative joy is consistently achieved in stage 8, and sustained meditative joy, along with the blisses of mental and physical pliancy, is the defining characteristic of stage 9. As you become more familiar with the state of meditative joy during the course of stage 9, there is a subsiding of intensity of the blisses of physical and mental pliancy. Meditative joy continues, but as the intensity and excitement fade, tranquility follows. As tranquility becomes strongly established, equanimity develops, meaning you no longer react to pleasant and unpleasant feelings the way you normally would. Both tranquility and equanimity are the fruits of stage 9, and mark your entry into the 10th and final stage of adept practice. The mind is almost completely unified, and all 5 characteristics of shamatha, stable attention, samadhi, powerful mindfulness, sati, joy, piti, tranquility, pasadi, and equanimity, upekkha, are now fully established. When the mind has become fully unified in stage 10, there is persistence of shamatha between meditation sessions. A summary of the unification process. Pacification of the discriminating mind starts in stage 6, continues in stage 7 as the mind begins to unify, and culminates with the effortlessness of mental pliancy in stage 8, at which point you have become an adept practitioner. Pacification of the senses starts in stage 7 and finishes at the end of stage 8. With full pacification, physical pliancy and meditative joy arise, along with the blisses of physical and mental pliancy. The intensity of the blisses of physical and mental pliancy subsides in stage 9, giving rise to tranquility and equanimity. In stage 10, with the unification of mind almost complete, all 5 characteristics of shamatha are fully established. By the end of stage 10, the shamatha of the adept continues uninterrupted in daily life. Pacification of the senses and meditative joy. As the mind grows more unified, you will experience both complete pacification of the senses and the arising of meditative joy. The former begins with a variety of unusual sensory experiences that eventually lead to total quieting of the senses, as well as physical pliancy and the bliss of physical pliancy. Meditative joy, on the other hand, is preceded by distinctive energy currents, which increase in intensity until you experience the full fruition of joy and the bliss of mental pliancy. These 2 processes happen at the same time, and although they're connected, each has its own specific characteristics. We describe both processes in this interlude because they span stages 7 and 8 and don't neatly fit into a discussion of either stage. We'll first look at pacification of the senses and meditative joy separately, then discuss how they intermingle and complement one another. Pacification of the senses, from unusual sensations to physical pliancy. Pacification of the senses comes from consistently ignoring normal sensory information presented in awareness. Eventually, the sensory sub-minds stop projecting that content into consciousness at all. When this happens, it means the sensory sub-minds are unified around a common intention not to interrupt the focus of attention, resulting in complete pacification and physical pliancy. This temporary suspension of conscious information processing for all the senses is one of the 2 key features of full pacification of the senses. The other is that, with several of the senses, ordinary sensations not only disappear, but are replaced by internally generated perceptions. For example, you may see an inner light or hear an inner sound. These internally generated perceptions are quite different from imagination or memory. For one thing, they are much more real. They are also entirely spontaneous and can't be intentionally induced. Before pacification of the senses is complete, however, you'll experience a host of unusual, even bizarre, sensory phenomena produced by the sub-minds. Even though these strange sensory experiences are so totally different from the internally generated perceptions of physical pliancy, they are, in fact, the precursors to them. Keep in mind that all these amazing, even fantastic-sounding pacification experiences have no significance in themselves except to indicate that the mind is growing more unified. Also, unlike the meditation experiences that occur during the first six stages, the pacification process can differ significantly from person to person. You may well have experiences different from those we describe here. Nevertheless, the basic features should be recognizably the same. Pacification of the bodily senses. As the process of pacification unfolds, you'll likely experience some bizarre physical sensations and autonomic reactions before you reach physical pliancy. For instance, you may encounter feelings of warmth or coolness on the skin. These may be stationary or moving, increasing or decreasing in intensity, and either pleasant or unpleasant. You may experience chills, shivers, skin flushing, hot flashes, and find your hairs standing on end. There may be itchiness or a sensation like insects crawling on your skin. You may encounter numbness, tingling, electric-like shocks, or sharp pinpricks. There can be pleasurable feelings in some particular body part, including sexual sensations, or there can be waves of pleasure spreading over the entire body. People often feel very light, as if they were floating, but there can also be sensations of heaviness and pressure, especially in or on top of the head. Another common sensation is of falling forward or to one side, or of the body or head twisting, even though no actual movement takes place. There may be dizziness and nausea as well. Some people experience only a few of these, while others may have to deal with them all. Most meditators fall somewhere in between. In any case, what you experience during the process of pacification is so different from complete pacification that you may find it hard to believe they are connected at all. Once the bodily senses are fully pacified, there will be a dramatic change during meditation in how you experience ordinary bodily sensations, proprioception, and the mental image you have of your body. Before pacification, when meditating, we are usually quite aware of many tactile and other bodily sensations, pain in the muscles and joints, burning and pressure where our body touches the cushion, temperature sensations, and pressure and touch where body parts contact each other or our clothing. However, when the senses are completely pacified and physical pliancy arises, we cease to be aware of all these sensations. Instead, you may feel as though your body is completely empty inside, that there is nothing more than a thin membrane or shell at the surface of your body from which all sensations have disappeared. You'll have little more than a vague awareness of your body occupying space. Alternatively, you may experience the surface of your body as very fine, effervescent tingling or vibrations. Some say it feels like there is nothing but a fine energy field defining the space occupied by the body. Others find it hard to describe how their perception of the body is altered at all, except to say that none of the usual sensations are present. When pressure sensations disappear, it's common for meditators to report feeling as though they're floating in midair or weightless. But the most consistently reported experience is one of perfect stillness, accompanied by a wonderful sense of comfort and pleasure that uniformly pervades the body. Meditators have even described this pleasure as extending to the very tips of their hairs. Proprioception, Awareness of the position and location of the parts of your body also changes with complete pacification. When our eyes are closed, we usually know exactly where the parts of our body are and can accurately reach over and touch any part with our hand. With pacification of the bodily senses, however, it's not uncommon to feel as though your body is in a completely different position from what you know it to be, such as standing rather than sitting, arms straight rather than folded, or leaning over rather than sitting erect. Closely related to proprioceptive awareness is the internal mental image we have of our own bodies. Even when we're not consciously thinking about it, this image is always present somewhere in the background of body awareness. It's common for this image not to correspond exactly to what we see in the mirror or what gets captured by a camera. After all, who hasn't, at some time, experienced surprise when looking at themselves in a photograph, wondering if that's what they really look like? Yet when physical pliancy is fully developed, we can experience a mental self-image that differs even more radically from our actual appearance. For example, I, Chuladasa, am a rather funny-looking fellow, with ears that stick way out, and a face that shows the effects of time and too much sun. People often say I look a bit like Yoda. When I meditate, I sit cross-legged on a flat cushion with my right hand resting on my left hand in my lap. However, when I am in a state of physical pliancy, I sometimes have the perception that I'm standing upright. And even though one hand is resting on the other in my lap, it often feels like my right arm is extended downward. My mental image is of a beautiful face with smooth, glowing skin. Not every meditator will have experiences where the body seems to be in such a dramatically different position. But with physical pliancy, all meditators do tend to experience an altered mental image of themselves. There is no particular mystical significance to these self-images. In my case, I've spent a part of almost every day for the past 25 years in the presence of brass or wooden images portraying the Buddha standing with his right hand directed downward. I have these particular images because I like them. So the specifics of this self-image have more to do with familiarity, personal preference, and spiritual aspiration than with anything else. Please understand, we're not describing a trance-like state. Any strong or unusual tactile stimulus, say someone touching your shoulder, will register in consciousness, though you may prefer not to respond. This shows that the mind continues to process sensory information at an unconscious level. Also, all you need to do to become fully aware of ordinary tactile sensations is to intentionally shift your attention. You can easily move back and forth between isolated sensations and the altered perceptions of physical pliancy. Yet if your bodily senses are strongly pacified, it may take you a few moments to regain your normal awareness of the whole body. You might even need to move some part of your body to completely restore normal proprioception, especially if you've been sitting in physical pliancy for a long time. Typically, there's some inner resistance to giving up the pleasure of physical pliancy. Pacification of the visual sense. Normally, even with our eyes closed, the visual mind isn't truly quiescent. It keeps searching for possible images to present in consciousness, though usually all we can see through our eyelids are subtle changes in light and shadow. Still, the mind tends to generate its own imagery, sometimes in abundance, a common distraction during meditation. Either way, it's rare for someone to experience a complete absence of visual awareness. As the visual sense becomes pacified, however, an inner illumination typically arises, which eventually dominates our visual field, replacing all other mental imagery. The earliest signs of this illumination phenomenon usually take the form of brief flashes, often colored, which may be weak or intense. However, you may instead experience a small bright point or disc that may or may not be colored, move, change in intensity, or expand and contract. Another early presentation of illumination is a shapeless brightness, as though someone were shining a light on your closed eyelids. This, too, may change in intensity or move. Alternatively, the illumination may appear diffuse, smoky, and indistinct, and may or may not be colored. These early illumination experiences tend to be brief, intermittent, and unpredictable. Everyone is different, so you may experience any of these, or not at all. For a few, the illumination phenomenon simply never happens. As pacification proceeds over time, illumination phenomena tend to become more frequent and last longer. They also tend to grow brighter and more stable, and eventually enlarge to fill your whole visual field. If the light is colored, it tends to fade to colorlessness. For some, illumination phenomena are subtle and may not emerge distinctly until all the other senses are pacified. It's best not to have expectations or judge the quality of your practice by the presence or absence of these phenomena. When the visual sense is fully pacified, the illumination phenomenon often takes the form of an all-pervading light, so-called because of its intensity and scope, and because it seems to come from no particular direction. However, you can also experience it as coming from the top of your head, from somewhere just above the head, from the center of your chest, or as radiating from your entire body. The all-pervading light is usually quite white, clear, or at most faintly tinted, but not always. It can become very bright without disturbing you. In fact, when physical pliancy is well established, illumination becomes such a familiar, consistent, and predictable part of meditation that you may even stop noticing it. When you open your eyes, the illumination disappears, and normal vision instantly returns. Pacification of the auditory sense. The auditory sense also produces unusual phenomena as it's pacified. However, unlike the other senses, these experiences won't change much or at all as pacification proceeds. That is to say, the auditory phenomena you'll encounter during pacification are much the same as what you'll experience once pacification is complete. Our usual awareness of external noises, inner dialogue, remembered or imagined sounds, or tunes in the head gets replaced by a kind of white noise. You may hear humming, buzzing, whining, murmuring, or a ringing sound. It may remind you of crickets at night, flowing water, waves on the beach, or wind in the trees. For some, it resembles far-off music, which may be quite lovely. For others, it's less pleasant. The sound may rise and fall in pitch and/or intensity, and the changes may be fast or slow. What's consistent, though, is that the sound comes from within and masks most external sounds, and that you'll eventually get so used to it that you no longer even notice. Some people have suggested that the sounds are of ordinary origin, such as blood flowing, air moving, or tinnitus, and were always there, but were only noticed in the silence and heightened awareness of meditation. Most meditators eventually become convinced it is none of these. Although some form of mind-generated white noise seems almost universal, some practitioners don't seem to notice it until prompted to reflect on their experience. They may even deny it occurs until they actually listen for it while in deep meditation. Still, it's possible there are people who don't encounter it at all. This inner sound serves no particular purpose, except perhaps to replace all but the most intrusive of external sounds. More generally, as each sense becomes pacified, you stop being consciously aware of stimuli, unless they're particularly intense or unusual. Therefore, you'll no longer be aware of traffic noises, barking dogs, or birds chirping. But you may still notice a door slamming or somebody shouting. You'll also still respond to sounds that are strongly associated with a conditioned response, such as the meditation bell. The fact that intense, unusual, or conditioned stimuli still register in consciousness show that the mind still processes auditory information at an unconscious level. Also, By intentionally shifting your attention, you'll once more become fully aware of ambient sounds. Pacification of the senses of taste and smell. When there's nothing to taste or smell, and when attention is not directed to these senses, they tend to remain completely absent from conscious awareness. Likewise, most meditators, even with physical pliancy, are simply unaware of any tastes or smells. Yet there is the occasional meditator who reports the scent of incense, flowers, or some other fragrance. There are also a few who experience a pleasant taste. These mind-generated perceptions are sometimes referred to as divine fragrances and nectars. Their presence in a few meditators, together with the absence of illumination phenomenon in some, and perhaps the absence of white noise in others, all demonstrate how pacification experiences can vary from person to person. The significance of these strange sensations. During pacification of the senses, it's as if the sensory minds react to being ignored by throwing up all sorts of strange and sometimes unpleasant sensations that have nothing to do with anything happening externally. Also, even though these inner lights and sounds may help prevent distraction by ordinary stimuli, they often don't appear until the senses have already begun to grow quiet. Thus, it appears inner light and sound are more a result of pacification than a contributing cause. However, arising as they often do, just when the practice has become tedious, they can provide encouragement and reassurance and boost motivation. Once they arise, they can easily become the focus of attention, and there are some practices, such as light, sound, and nectar meditations, that purposely cultivate these phenomena as meditation objects. The illumination phenomenon can be used to enter meditative absorptions, and this method will be discussed in Stage 8. In this system of practice, however, you are strongly advised to simply ignore most of these phenomena until sensory pacification is complete. Meditative joy, from energy currents to the bliss of mental pliancy. The feeling of energy currents moving through the body is related to and precedes the arising of meditative joy. These currents grow stronger and more defined as meditative joy becomes more fully established. Even though they are felt in the body and happen at the same time as the strange bodily sensations due to pacification of the senses, they are distinct from them. Energy currents and unusual bodily sensations only occur together because both are connected to the same underlying process, unification of the mind. Also, as we'll discuss, energy currents are ultimately of far more practical significance than the strange sensations during pacification. The earliest manifestations of energy are little more than an electrical tingling on the scalp or vibrations in different parts of the body. However, the full experience of energy currents can take any form, from sudden, intense, and unpleasant, to continuous, smooth, and extremely pleasant. Involuntary body movements often occur as part of these energy experiences as well, including twitching, especially of the hands and thumbs, jerking, swaying, rocking, bending the torso forward and or the head backward, muscle clenching, rolling and writhing movements of the shoulders and arms, and shaking or trembling. You may also experience sudden upward lurches, as though you were trying to leap into the air, involuntary vocalizations, chewing movements, and lip pursing. Common autonomic reactions are salivating, sweating, tears, and the occasional runny nose. Some meditators experience racing heartbeat or irregular heartbeats, as though your heart is turning over in your chest. Quite rarely, there can be vomiting or diarrhea. As dramatic and unpleasant as these may be, you're in no real danger. Working with inner energy currents and channels is a recurrent theme in many traditions. This energy is variously called chi, prana, kriya, kundalini, or inner wind. There are detailed systems describing the channels, meridians, nadis, and chakras through which it flows, and there are powerful practices for working with this energy. Of all these traditions, the Theravada Buddhists have the least to say about energy movements. Their advice is simply to treat them the same way you treat any other experience that arises in meditation. Note it, let it be, and ignore it until it goes away. With a milder manifestation of energy, just letting it be is certainly the best advice, since it's so easy to get caught up in trying to control and manipulate it. Yet as with everything else in this journey, there are tremendous variations in the intensity of the experience. For some, energy movements are subtle and quickly lead to pleasurable sensations pervading the whole body. Others undergo a prolonged process involving violent energy surges and painful blockages. If you experience these more intense manifestations, you may need to work intentionally with the energy in some way. Tai Chi, Qigong, and yoga can all be helpful additions to formal meditation because they work directly with the energy movements in the body. Many meditators first encounter these energy currents in the form of sudden, violent jolts coursing up their spine. However, if you have practiced experiencing the whole body with the breath, described in Stage 6, you're already somewhat familiar with these energy currents and will be much better prepared to deal with them. Instead of being surprised by abrupt jolts of energy, you will instead experience a gradually increasing awareness of them that unfolds more predictably and systematically. 1. First, you become aware of subtle sensations in your limbs and extremities that rhythmically increase and decrease together with the breath. 2. As your practice proceeds, these subtle sensations clearly become sensations of expansion and contraction, or of pressure that alternately increases and decreases. 3. Eventually, you also become aware of a fine vibrational energy flowing out from the core of the body toward the extremities, then back. Sometimes the current will feel quite strong, like a powerful wave surging outward and back. More often, it feels like the whole body is gently rising and falling as the energy flows through it with each breath. 4. You'll observe the wave-like movement of energy is slightly out of phase with the breath. It also doesn't occur at exactly the same frequency as the breath, so the phase relationship between the breath and energy movements tends to change over time. 5. At some point, you become aware of energy moving up and down the spinal axis of the body. The upward movements from the base of the spine to the head are typically stronger and more distinct than the downward movements. Also, they often produce a sensation of pressure inside the head. The phase and frequency of the spinal energy movements eventually become completely dissociated from the breath. 6. If you're already aware of and following the energy from core to extremities before you experience these spinal currents, then their intensity tends to increase in a gentler, more gradual way. They may even be pleasant. However, if they're your first experience of energy currents, they may feel abrupt and painful, like a jolt of energy or an electric shock. One of the benefits of doing body scanning and experiencing the whole body with the breath is that you become familiar and more comfortable with these energy sensations earlier. 7. Finally, rather than alternating back and forth, the flow of energy becomes a continuous circular movement between the core and extremities and the base of the spine and the head. This coincides with the experience of strong meditative joy and sustained pervasive physical pleasure. Your perception of flowing energy may even extend beyond the body itself. You might sense a continuous energy exchange with the universe around you, taking place through the top of your head, the base of your spine, and your palms and soles. Remember, these energy currents are actually manifestations of unification of mind and lead to a mental state called meditative joy. There is absolutely nothing in the human body that corresponds anatomically to these energy currents or the channels through which they seem to move. This means that despite their intensity, these currents can't actually harm the body. Important reminders about extraordinary experiences. All these extraordinary experiences develop spontaneously as a result of continuing to practice. Remember, they serve no particular purpose and are irrelevant to the specific goals of each stage. However, they can be so unusual and fascinating that you'll find it hard to resist dwelling on them a bit. It's important that you don't disrupt your cultivation of physical pliancy and meditative joy by pursuing or deliberately trying to invoke them. This is especially true early on, when their appearances are brief and unpredictable. Later, when effortless concentration is well established and these phenomena stabilize, they are as suitable as any other object for close investigation. Pacification of the senses and meditative joy arise together. The five grades of piti. As the mind grows unified, the strange sensations leading to physical pliancy and the energy currents and involuntary movements preceding meditative joy all happen at the same time. The Theravada Buddhist tradition describes this intertwined process as five successive levels or grades of completeness of the development of piti. Piti is a Pali term often translated as ecstasy, delight, or rapture. Literally, the term refers solely to meditative joy. However, grades of piti refers to the entire developmental process, including sensory pacification and the blisses of physical and mental pliancy, as well as the gradual arising of joy. Therefore, when we discuss these grades of piti, we describe the way various unusual sensory and energetic experiences arise together at each grade. Grade 1 piti is called the minor grade and consists of brief, unpredictable episodes with only one or a few unusual sensations or involuntary body movements happening at once. For example, you might see some colored light or experience a tingling sensation spreading over your face, or your thumbs might start twitching, followed by a pleasurable sensation in your hands and arms. Minor piti can occur at any stage, but rarely before stage 4. It becomes more likely in stages 5 and 6, and is almost always present by stage 7. Grade 2 piti, the momentary grade, consists of brief episodes with a greater number of different phenomena occurring at the same time. You may experience lights, sounds, unusual bodily sensations, and autonomic reactions. Infrequently, energy sensations and pleasurable sensations in the body, involuntary movements, and feelings of happiness may be present too. The episodes are brief, hence the description as momentary. Grade 2 piti is typical of stages 7 and 8, but is not unusual in stages 5 and 6. Grade 3 piti episodes last longer and are called wave-like, because their intensity alternately increases and decreases. They are also described as showering, because of the way intense sensations often spread over the body. The sensory phenomena and body movements tend to be much more intense compared to earlier grades. It's also common to feel energy currents. It can be hard to believe this tempestuous process is a pacification of anything. It's also not unusual to have a combination of both pleasant and unpleasant experiences, but the pleasant aspects will predominate as you move toward the next grade. Wave-like piti is a principal feature of stage 8, but is common in stage 7 as well. For a few meditators, it may also be a rare occurrence at earlier stages. Notice these first three grades of piti are mostly grades of incomplete pacification of the senses. But with the advent of grade 4 piti, pacification is largely complete. Some people do experience energy manifestations and involuntary movements in these three grades, and joy can make an occasional appearance in grade 3. But for many, this doesn't happen. The strong movements of energy that herald the arising of meditative joy are really most characteristic of grade 4 piti and continue into grade 5. Grade 4 piti, the exhilarating grade, involves intense and sustained manifestations of physical pliancy. This means ordinary tactile sensations, as well as feelings of temperature and pain, are usually absent, and the body often feels light, or like it's floating weightlessly in midair. Distorted perceptions of the body's position and location are typical. The illumination phenomenon can also be particularly intense. Pleasurable sensations, such as experiencing the whole body as a field of very fine, rapid vibrations, and strong feelings of meditative joy, are intermittently present. The combination of intensity, sensations of floating, and meditative joy are probably why this grade is also known as uplifting piti. The description that best characterizes grade 4 piti, however, is incomplete and interrupted arising of meditative joy. Sensations of electricity or powerful energy currents will surge coarsely through the body. These are often accompanied by uncontrollable body movements such as the torso swaying back and forth, sudden violent jerks, or arms flinging. Grade 4 piti occurs almost exclusively in stage 8, but occasionally in stage 9. The exhilarating grade of piti eventually gives way to grade 5, pervading piti. This marks the full maturation of physical pliancy and meditative joy. You'll perceive energy currents circulating smoothly through the body, along with physical comfort, pleasure, stability, and intense joy. Recall that these different grades of piti are all phases in the process of unification. As the mind grows more unified, joy increases. When there's enough unification, the joy, along with the bliss of physical pliancy, becomes pervasive and lasting. Grade 5 piti marks mastery of stage 8 and entry into stage 9. Not everyone experiences all the transitional grades of piti. Some just encounter grades 1 and 2, with only minor symptoms like thumbs twitching or rocking movements, increased salivation, and mildly pleasant energy currents before they reach physical pliancy and meditative joy. Others progress one grade at a time, enduring months of unpleasant sensations, or even pain, twitching, itching, jerking, shivering, nausea, and sweating. The consolation for those who have a hard time is that they're typically the ones who report the most intense pleasure and joy in the end. Also, don't feel like you're missing out if you don't encounter the peculiar experiences that make up the various grades of piti. Some people don't. And all the drama, intensity, and ecstasy of piti are only incidental anyway. What matters most is making the mind into a serviceable instrument for achieving insight. Purification of the mind. Physical pliancy and meditative joy come quickly and easily for some, but slowly and arduously for others. Physiology and genetics may play a role, as do differences in temperament and psychological disposition. Physical, mental, and emotional health are also factors, which can be addressed through diet, exercise, good work and recreation habits, and appropriate therapy, if necessary. However, the biggest obstacles are often the hindrances of aversion and agitation due to worry and remorse. How we condition our mind on a daily basis has a powerful influence over these hindrances, and practices that purify the mind can be extremely helpful. The hindrance of aversion. The hindrance of aversion keeps physical pliancy and the blisses of physical and mental pliancy from arising. Any negative mental state, such as impatience, fear, resentment, hatred, or a critical attitude toward ourselves or others, can disrupt progress. Likewise, both stubbornness and a domineering or manipulative attitude can also create roadblocks. As long as any of these are present, Even if we're not conscious of them, it will impede the flowering of pacification and physical and mental pliancy. That aversion opposes pleasure should not come as a surprise. It's harder to feel pleasure when we're angry, and harder to stay angry when we're feeling pleasure and happiness. But there's more to it than that, because aversion is a cause of pain, as well as an effect. Psychology and medical science have shown how unconscious mental processes, such as aversion, can find expression through bodily sensations and physical changes. We often become aware of our own emotions through unpleasant sensations in our stomach, chest, or throat, for example, or tension in our shoulders, forehead, or around the eyes, or from clenching our jaw. The body and mind are not distinct, but rather make up a complex, interconnected whole that can be called the body-mind. Likewise, unpleasant bodily sensations occurring during pacification often have their origins in deeply held but quite unconscious negative emotional states. This is the origin of the pain and discomfort that block physical pliancy. The hindrance of agitation due to worry and remorse. Agitation due to worry and remorse hinders the arising of meditative joy. Even if we're enjoying a stable, exclusive focus of attention and a mind seemingly free from thoughts, the discriminating mind still continues processing information and past experiences in the unconscious. Remorse for things we've done in the past and worries about what may happen in the future fester, even when we're not consciously aware of them. This agitation manifests as intense but obstructed energy flows in the body. Meditative joy arises easily in a mind free from worry and remorse, but in their presence, the joy is incomplete and cannot be sustained. Until we achieve some inner resolution, our past misdeeds will keep producing agitation. Likewise, until we overcome our fears about what may happen, worry will agitate the mind and prevent the full experience of meditative joy. Joy is a state of mind most easily understood by comparing it with its opposite, grief and sadness. Those who grieve are often filled with remorse. Sadness makes us pessimistic, lacking in confidence, and consequently we worry about all kinds of things. Joy, on the other hand, is associated with happiness, optimism, and confidence. Joyful people don't worry, because they feel confident enough to deal with whatever comes their way. They also sincerely regret any harm they cause, are eager to set things right, and try to change their ways in the future. Remember, joy and sadness are incompatible mental states that simply cannot coexist. As your mind grows more unified through pacifying the senses, meditative joy begins to develop. And as it increases, it eventually dispels agitation due to worry and remorse. However, don't just wait for this process to unfold on its own. Some powerful remedies. Please don't make the mistake of blaming yourself if you have these kinds of difficulties in meditation. And don't blame yourself for blaming yourself. No one comes to this practice without ample cause for aversion, worry, and remorse. Creating more self-directed negativity won't help. Instead, purify your mind of aversion and ill will to speed up and smooth out the process of pacifying the senses. The practice of loving-kindness meditation is a powerful and effective tool for this. Yet purification requires more than loving-kindness. We need to be mindful of our thoughts, emotions, and behavior at all times, and learn to let go of bad habits of thought, speech, and action. As an adept practitioner, you can no longer separate meditation from the rest of your life. The influence of your meditation practice, of everything else you think, feel, or do, as well as the views you hold at other times, in other situations, is simply too great. To speed up and smooth out the arising of meditative joy, cultivate joy at every opportunity in daily life as well. Be mindful of pessimistic thoughts, and, to the best of your ability, avoid associating with pessimistic people. When you catch yourself worrying or doubting yourself, let go of those thoughts, and try to think about something positive instead. Resolve any lingering sources of worry and remorse, and find ways to right past wrongs and seek forgiveness for past misdeeds wherever possible. Own your mistakes. Make amends. Ask for others' forgiveness. And forgive yourself. It's also essential to practice virtue in daily life. By refraining from unwholesome behavior and engaging in virtuous actions, you'll no longer act in ways that create the conditions for future worry and remorse. The practices of generosity, virtue, patience, and joyful effort are indispensable for success in the more advanced stages, and will yield immeasurable benefits in the rest of your life as well. To help you along this path of purification, take up the Mindful Review practice. Mindful Review turns daily reflection into a powerful tool for personal change. Although this practice is appropriate at any stage, it's essential for making progress as an adept. We waited until now to introduce it only because it can easily be mistaken for an empty, moralistic ritual. Yet the sooner you begin this practice or another systematic technique that cultivates mindfulness, virtue, generosity, and patience in daily life, the faster you'll progress on the cushion. His mind is not overcome with passion, not overcome with aversion, not overcome with delusion. His mind heads straight, based on the Tathagata. And when the mind is headed straight, the disciple of the Noble Ones gains a sense of the goal, gains a sense of the Dhamma, gains joy connected with the Dhamma. In one who is joyful, rapture arises. In one who is rapturous, the body grows calm. One whose body is calmed experiences ease. In one at ease, the mind becomes concentrated. Mahanama Sutta. Insight experiences and the attainment of insight. You've likely gained a lot of insight as a result of your practice by now. Insights into why you think and react the way you do, how your mind works, and better ways of dealing with life situations. I'm referring to the ordinary insights that help us in our life, but don't radically transform how we understand the world and our place in it. However, from this point forward, we will increasingly have insight experiences that can trigger the kind of insight, vipassana, that leads to awakening. What makes them insight experiences is the way they challenge your understanding of how things are by clearly demonstrating they're different from what you previously believed. This type of insight is the real goal of meditation practice. First, powerful insight experiences will happen more frequently, both in meditation and daily life, because of how you've trained and used your mind. In the stages that follow, we introduce a range of practices specifically intended to induce insight experiences. Second, these experiences are now far more likely to give rise to actual insight, since mindfulness in the form of metacognitive awareness doesn't allow them to go unrecognized. This may come as a surprise, but insight experiences aren't uncommon, even among people without meditation training. They just tend to be overlooked, ignored, or simply dismissed. Even meditators sometimes just treat them as a nuisance, distraction, or obstacle to perfecting their skills. Whether or not these experiences bear fruit as actual insight depends on the meditator's ability to properly appreciate and engage with them as they arise. When we have more stable attention and powerful mindfulness, they are far more likely to sink in as experiential realities, forcing unconscious sub-minds to revise deeply held views at an intuitive level. As insight accumulates, your understanding of yourself in relationship to the world changes. This happens at such a fundamental level that the effects can be enormously unsettling. This is normal, and in fact inevitable. In other words, we're giving you a heads up that awakening is not without its price of admission. Let's look at why this can be so difficult by first summarizing the universally accepted worldview. Whether we're consciously aware of it or not, that view is the foundation of all our beliefs, actions, aspirations, and our very sense of meaning and purpose. 1. I am a separate entity, a self, in a world of other distinct entities. 2. My happiness and unhappiness depend on the interactions between myself and those other entities. 3. I rely on my presumed ability to understand and predict how this world works in order to control or influence those interactions in a way that maximizes my happiness and minimizes my suffering. The truth revealed by insight stands in stark contradiction to these assumptions, and unfortunately, before insight can give rise to a greater liberating truth, this old foundation must fall away. This is not a pleasant experience, and the emotional distress it produces can sometimes be extreme. If you recall from the introduction, there are 5 key insights that lead to awakening: impermanence, emptiness, the causal interdependence of all phenomena, the nature of suffering, and the illusoriness of a separate self. The 5th, insight into no self, is the culminating insight that actually brings awakening. Immature insight into the first 4 of these, but not the 5th, is what produces the most difficulty. In other words, as long as we cling to the notion of self, the implications of the other insights are deeply disturbing. Consider what it's like for our unconscious sub-minds when, still clinging to the view that we are a separate self, they must assimilate. The fact of impermanence, that there is only change and there's nothing to cling to or rely on. The fact of emptiness, that nothing is the way it appears, and the world is ultimately unknowable except through our limited capacity for inference, and the fact that everything is causally independent, which destroys all illusions of control. In the calculus of insight, it's the continued clinging to the notion of separate selfhood in the face of these 3 insights that produces a first-hand experience of insight into the nature of suffering. Realizing that you're not a separate self is what resolves this apparently hopeless situation. This isn't the place to discuss why this is or how it happens, but anything that loosens your attachment to the notion of self will help. Fortunately, there are ways of easing this transition. These factors will minimize the psychological trauma associated with maturing insight and smooth the transition to awakening. 1. How successful you were in allowing the emotional purifications of stages 4 and 7 to fully unfold, so you're not forced to experience them as part of the insight process. 2. How much of the meditative joy of stages 7 and 8, the tranquility of stage 9, and the equanimity of stages 9 and 10 you've been able to cultivate. 3. How clearly you understand the illusoriness of the separate self, anatta. 4. How fully you've experientially verified for yourself the descriptions of the mind system presented in the 5th and 7th interludes. 5. How effective you've been in reducing self-clinging and subsequent craving by using the mindful review practice. Self-conquest is far greater than conquering all others. Not gods, nor angels, nor Mara or Brahma can overturn such a victory. Dhammapada, verses 104 to 105.